Granted, the president appears to his the United States appears to have begun the process of reengaging with the Sunni tribal leaders that lost all confidence in the United States after the abandonment of Iraq. And so I think we're the incremental part of this is that as he sees the threat grow, he's moving in the right direction, but it isn't a strategy. A strategy would require a comprehensive approach.
Is this a serious enough threat that American lives should be on the line? You have laid out, for example, forward air controllers who would help guide airstrikes. Those are people who might be killed.
Yes,
Americans.
It is a serious threat. When you have 4 million refugees in Syria and 4 million in camps, literally, you know, millions at a time in Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan, the destabilizing impact that has on those countries and the potential of a breeding ground for Islamic jihadist activity for a long, long while, that's a serious threat. I view it as a threat because it's a long-term threat against Western civilization. They effectively had declared war on us. I think sometimes the president infers that, well, it's not a threat because they're not going to invade us. Well, they could destabilize our way of life in a really serious way.
Are they an existential threat?
They are. And if anybody doesn't think that they would use whatever means possible to do us harm, I think they're naive. And look, you saw it in place. I mean, the Los Angeles school district was closed for 2 days because of a potential threat coming from an email.
Is that a sign of overreacting?
Well, I was going to complete the sentence that part of the job of a president is to distinguish between the two, make sure that people know that we view it as a threat, that we're because people are scared and they're legitimately so, take action accordingly, and then you're going to lessen people's fears on the day-to-day activities. We can't be paralyzed in place. And that's where we are today.
At the same time, you said let's not overstate the threat from ISIS. Are some of your rivals for the Republican nomination playing up the threat from ISIS for political reasons?
Well, I mean, Trump, clearly banning all Muslims would actually be so counterproductive in our efforts to destroy ISIS that it's foolhardy. I mean, it's beyond ridiculous. It's quite dangerous. So he's clearly playing that card, talking about carpet bombing. That might be a overstatement of a strategy. But it is a threat. Look, I don't want you to hear me and think that I'm discounting this threat. What I'm saying is the president actually talks about it as though it's a law enforcement exercise in some ways, and I think it's bigger than that.
What did you think, Governor, when Donald Trump called for banning Muslims from entering the country for a time? You called him unhinged. And then surveys came out, and it was revealed that majorities of Republican primary voters said they agreed with him.
Well, and a month from now, they won't. That's the point. The point is that we're living in this reality TV kind of political environment where he fills the space by saying outrageous things. People, based on their emotion, will express support for the sentiment, not necessarily the specifics because they're none. And then he'll backtrack. And he'll move on to the next thing, and he fills the space.
You think if another poll was done in a month or two, people would completely change their view on that?
I think the emotion of the here and now will subside. Are people scared about the national security interests of our country being violated because of a lax immigration system or a visa waiver program that wasn't designed for people being radicalized? Yeah, they're scared. And the job of a president or a candidate, for that matter, isn't to scare them more. It's to give them solutions, and that's what I'm trying to do.
That's former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. Now, when he spoke of waiting for the emotions of the here and now to subside, he could almost have been talking of his entire campaign. The Republican is determined to last long enough in the race that voters give him a second look. Elsewhere in today's program, Bush talks of his party's future.
And that's not all. While campaigning this year, Jeb Bush said he makes, quote, really good guacamole. Campaign reporters, always hungry for news, have been seeking that recipe ever since. He gives it up, sort of, at NPR.org.
Now, whoever wins the presidency will be managing one of America's most vital friendships. It's the relationship with Saudi Arabia, whose rulers have been close to the United States for generations.
And for all their wealth, the Saudis are facing a tough economic year. In fact, a nearly $100 billion deficit, prompting the government this week to announce big budget cuts and propose new taxes. Citizens of the kingdom are also facing sticker shock at the gas station. This gigantic oil producer is raising domestic fuel prices. NPR's Deborah Amos recently returned from Saudi Arabia. Good morning.
Good morning.
And let me get this straight. There is something of a panic in Saudi Arabia about getting gas?
Yeah, there were extraordinary scenes in Saudi on Monday. Huge lines at the gas pumps to fill up before those gas prices went up. All of this came on the same day that the government announced its 2016 budget. A dramatic drop in oil prices blew a big hole in that budget, so there were immediate subsidy cuts for water, for electricity, and gas. The gas is still ridiculously cheap. We're talking about $1 a gallon. But this is just the beginning of a five-year reform plan. I talked to economist John Sfakianakis, and he says Saudi officials have to show they're adjusting to the new reality of the oil market.
The era of plenty has come to an end. The party's over, and over the next year or so, you will see the introduction of a sales tax, a VAT tax, eventually some form of income tax.
You know, this is all pretty revolutionary stuff for a country that's used to the welfare state that's paid for by oil revenues.
Well, Deborah, will that lead to a revolution? I mean, many people hate to pay taxes.
Yeah, well, look, reactions have been all over the place. Angry, proud, jokes. The middle class reaction is the most interesting. A young Saudi woman wrote on Facebook, "I go to university with a royal, a princess. She doesn't pay for utilities or gas, so why should I?" Saudis are asking, "Will the royals pay their share? What do I get? Why don't I have a say in what's going on here?" You know, Americans know this phrase, no taxation without representation. Saudis could be asking the same thing.
Well, this matters, of course, because Saudi Arabia is a major player in the region. It's a big U.S. ally. It's also a rival to Iran. And it's been involved in wars in Syria and Yemen. So will it stay active in 2016? I mean, is it going to spend the money?
The budget numbers here are clear. The kingdom will continue to spend on arms even more next year than this one.
How, then, do you see this all shake out over the next year?
No one is willing to predict because this is a revolutionary change for Saudi Arabia, so expect a volatile year ahead in a country where stability really matters. But economists say oil prices are likely to remain low for some time. The energy markets have fundamentally changed. For the first time, with all this turmoil and all this uncertainty in the Middle East, the price of oil is going down and not up.
NPR's Deborah Amos is just back from Saudi Arabia. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:18, and you've tuned in to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us. Headlines are coming up next from NPR and WPR. Wisconsin's ice fishing season, and it's off to a slow start, but depending on where you are in the state, you may have a better chance at catching something. There's more from WPR's Patty Murray in just a couple minutes.
Support for WGTD's Radio Theater comes from the Lake Lawn Resort in Delavan, a full-service leisure getaway, family retreat, and meeting facility. Lake Lawn Resort, a proud supporter of WGTD's Radio Theater. LakeLawnResort.com.
Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support free, family-friendly events. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Floodwaters have spilled over at least 9 levees in the St. Louis area, protecting river communities and farmland in Missouri. The swollen Mississippi and the Merrimack rivers have forced hundreds of people from their homes and prompted dozens of water rescues. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says another 10 levees are being monitored closely. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports.
The Mississippi River around St. Louis, for example, is expected to reach nearly 13 feet above flood stage. That would be the second worst flood on record, behind only the devastating 1993 flood. Missouri's Governor Jay Nixon says this rare winter flood makes safety an issue, too, because low temperatures make the situation dangerous for recovery and cleanup efforts.
After 6 years, Turkey is ending its policy of visa-free travel for Syrians. NPR's Peter Kenyon says the change won't affect refugees coming by land.
Turkey's foreign ministry says beginning on January 8th, Syrians arriving by air or sea from third countries will need visas. Critics say the change is long overdue, but Turkey says its humanitarian open-door policy for refugees fleeing violence at home will not change. The EU has been pushing Ankara to stem the flow of migrants to Europe.
A million people are expected on the streets of New York City tonight for New Year's Eve in Times Square. In Belgium, New Year's Eve fireworks in Brussels are canceled over security concerns. I'm Dave Mattingly.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. Wisconsin's ice fishing season is off to a slow start. Large lakes like Winnebago are still open water, but some smaller lakes up north have enough ice to accommodate fishermen. Patty Murray reports.
Ice shanties are out on Lake Hayward, according to Robert Schuster, who manages Hayward Bait and Bottle. Normally, he says ice is thick enough by the end of November, but this year it was slow forming.
It's made it unseasonably slow in the shop compared to, you know, a normal year.
Schuster says ice fishers like to hit the lakes as early as possible because species like walleye move into deeper water as it gets colder. He reminds customers that no ice is safe ice, so they should use the buddy system. Two fishermen died on Sunday after falling through ice on the Glenlock flowage north of Chippewa Falls. Patty Murray, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin Red Cross volunteers are helping flood victims in Missouri and Illinois. Patty Flowers of Red Cross in Milwaukee says eight people from Wisconsin have been sent to the St. Louis area, and that number will certainly rise in the coming days. Volunteer Phyllis Williams says floods can be the hardest natural disasters for victims to deal with because they often keep reoccurring with more rain. The Midwest floods were part of the storm system that dumped up to 13 inches of snow in Wisconsin this week. There will be isolated flurries this morning in Wisconsin. Highs will be in the upper teens to the mid-20s. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. From CarMax, a nationwide retailer of used vehicles, where people can buy or sell their car, offering written vehicle appraisals good for 7 days. Learn more at CarMax.com. CarMax, the bright side of car buying. And from Inada, Japanese maker of full-body massage chairs, including the Flex 3S with pre-programmed shiatsu massages and full-body stretch sessions. At InadaUSA.com. That's InadaUSA.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. As presidential voting begins in the new year, two women are on the ballot. Hillary Clinton and Carly Fiorina symbolize change. You sense how much change when you consider the political life of a woman in an era before women commonly ran for office. She was the wife of Winston Churchill, who gave heroic speeches as British Prime Minister in World War II.
I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat.
The woman who helped craft those speeches was Clementine Churchill, actually Clementine, as she said it. Sonia Purnell wrote a book called Clementine.
I confess, like millions of others, I had absolutely no idea who Winston Churchill's wife was. But then I stumbled across this letter that she wrote to him in 1940 when he became Prime Minister and France had fallen, the Benelux countries had fallen. Really, Britain was all alone and everyone thought it was about to be invaded itself. But she realised that he was in danger of losing the support of the very people he needed most. He was being brusque and rude and rather overbearing. So she wrote him this letter and it just tells him how he needs to bring people alongside him to make them love him. His behaviour changed as a result of this, and people changed their minds about him. So once I'd read that letter, I couldn't wait to find out more.
Was that normal throughout their lives that she gave him specific political advice?
Oh, yes. I think she realised she couldn't be the ordinary wife. She would lose Winston. She would never see him. So really, from very, very early on, she threw herself into making herself the right sort of woman for him. She wanted to prove that she was up to it. A lot of people thought she wasn't when she first married him. She'd come from this rackety background. She was quite shy. And so she pushed herself to become this incredibly wise, measured, knowledgeable, well-read person.
You just said rackety background, which is a word I think I will now start using myself here in the United States. What was her rackety background?
Okay, well, she was the granddaughter of a Scottish earl, but her mother was something of a Victorian wild child, Lady Blanche. She was married off. It was a pretty loveless match. He didn't want children. She did. She went about this with some enthusiasm, shall we say.
Without him, I guess we should.
Without him, absolutely. She had up to 10 lovers on the go at once. As a result of this, her mother was shunned by polite society. She had very little money. They kept having to move house. None of this was the sort of life you would normally expect of the granddaughter of a Scottish earl.
What was it about Clementine, when Churchill finally did talk with her, that attracted him?
I think because of her rackety background, she had no money, she was making her own living. She wasn't like the normal society women that he'd met who were interested in frocks and balls and not much else. So suddenly, here was a woman who was interested in what he had to say about all sorts of things, and he found that thrilling. She found it rapturous that here was someone prepared to talk about the great and exciting world events, events which she wished she could be a part of.
Did she share his ambition to the extent of actually pushing him farther than he might have gone on his own?
I think he always wanted to be Prime Minister. She always wanted him to be Prime Minister too. I think the difference she made was that earlier in his career, he made countless mistakes. Take the Dardanelles, for instance, in the First World War, disastrous military campaign.
Let's say the word Gallipoli, just to remind people. The Gallipoli campaign,
yeah,
notorious defeat for the British, yes.
Exactly, and for many Empire troops. It's something that has, you know, stayed in history as a military disaster. You might argue it wasn't really Churchill's fault, or you might argue it was. In any case, he got the blame. And she saw that the way back, he had to redeem himself, and if by volunteering to fight in the trenches at the Western Front, he could somehow show people that he wasn't this hothead, he wasn't just all about him.
You describe a rather breathtaking moment in which Churchill has gone off to the Western Front, he's fighting with the British Army, and she writes him, does she not, to effectively say, don't come back too soon.
Yes, can you imagine? I mean, obviously she knew, as she put it, a wicked bullet could find him at any moment, but she wanted people to want him to come back. She knew that if he just came back, people would say, well, it's the same old Winston, he's not learned. If he stayed out there long enough that people realised that he was needed, then that would be different.
You've already given us a glimpse of Clementine advising Churchill as Prime Minister during World War II. Did she also become a power in her own right, someone that people would consult directly, who had her own sources of information, her own ways of getting things done?
She did. She saw that all Britain had in 1940, 1941 was a collective spirit, and that that had to be fostered and nurtured and protected. And yet people were discontented. The air raid shelters during the Blitz were pretty horrible. They were cold, they were dark, they were scary. And so she went about ordering government ministers around, please put heating in there, please make sure there's a fire exit there, please manufacture 2 million new beds so that people can sleep alongside their children during the raid to stop them becoming too frightened. She saw that by dealing with these problems, you would foster that incredible Blitz spirit that people still talk about now.
How, if at all, has this research affected the way that you think about modern political couples when you see them in the news?
Clementine, I think, found a way of doing some things on her own, but in other ways supporting Churchill as Prime Minister, that I would say is unique. And sometimes I look at some of the political spouses today and I wonder where their ambition is. I mean, obviously times are different now, but, you know, in Britain, you very rarely hear anything about the Prime Minister's wife apart from what frock she's wearing or where she went on holiday. I'm amazed, really, that we still in that position where we don't celebrate the fact that in many ways we get two for the price of one, because with the Churchills, we did.
Of course, here in the United States, we had a first couple who advertised themselves as two for the price of one in the 90s, and now the spouse is running for president.
Yes, and do you know what? I think Clementine would be absolutely thrilled if she was still around today. I mean, she once said in early in life, you know, she would have loved to have been a statesman in her own right if only she'd been born with trousers rather than petticoats. And I think if she were alive today, I suspect very much that she would be in the British cabinet. She would certainly be an MP, and maybe, who knows, she might have gone for the Prime Minister's job herself.
Sonia Purnell, author of Clementine, The Life of Mrs. Winston Churchill. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's NPR News.
Primary season is fast approaching, but all year, presidential candidates have been on the road figuring out where to find their voters.
God bless the great state of Iowa.
I've had a blast these last 24 hours in New Hampshire.
It's great to be back in South Carolina.
The 2016 campaign roadmap, who's been where, how many times, and what it tells us, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune into All Things Considered at 3 this afternoon here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep with one more obstacle faced by the world's refugees. Dozens of people seeking asylum in Sweden requested new accommodations. They say their refugee center is haunted by ghosts. They complained of flickering lights and noise in the plumbing. More than half the shelter residents asked to move, but they are staying after Swedish authorities said there was nowhere else for them to go. It was either the haunted house or Syria. You're listening to Morning Edition.
Good morning. It's 8:31 on the final day of 2015. Thanks for joining us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're here for you each weekday with the latest news. Plus, you can always follow news throughout the day online at WPR.org.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Local musicians, get your music on the radio on WGTD's Noon Tunes. It airs Monday through Friday on the WGTD Midday News. Email Dave McGrath at mcgrathd@gtc.edu.
Wisconsin Public Radio's mission is to inform, inspire, entertain, and engage you. Bold missions require dedicated leadership. If you can give $100 a month or more this year, please join our 9XM Leadership Circle. Your gift will provide a stable financial base for Wisconsin Public Radio and our programs, helping to fulfill our mission. To join, go to WPR.org and click Donate.
It'll be mostly cloudy in Wisconsin today, but in southern Wisconsin, the sun will be coming out by the afternoon. Isolated flurries are in the forecast for the morning, and highs will be in the upper teens in the northwest to the mid-20s in the east. Tonight, there is a chance of light snow in the northwest and isolated flurries in the far north. Lows will be about 10 degrees in the southwest to 10 to 15 degrees in the north and near Lake Michigan. And for tomorrow on New Year's Day, partly cloudy with isolated flurries in the far north.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the SCAN Foundation, working to advance a coordinated system of high-quality services for older adults that preserve dignity and independence. More information is available at thescanfoundation.org. From American Jewish World Service, working for 30 years to end poverty and advance human rights worldwide. Learn more at AJWS.org. And from Americans for the Arts at AmericansfortheArts.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel has come under pressure after a year that's brought police shooting after police shooting there. Tensions have been especially high since a video was released last month showing a teenager being shot by police 16 times. Just last weekend, a college student was killed, and police say they shot a grandmother to death accidentally. Yesterday, the mayor rolled out new plans aimed at reducing the use of deadly force by police, including more tasers in the hands of officers and more training for the force. Lou Reeder is a former deputy chief of police with the LAPD and a police trainer and consultant. He supports the changes outlined by the mayor, but says they aren't enough. According to him, one of the biggest challenges is breaking the code of silence.
The real issue here is you have to have officers who feel comfortable that they will come forth with testimony that might get another officer into trouble. If they step forward, if they do the right thing, they will inevitably end up being retaliated out by other officers. And we have to say that retaliation is real. It's sinister. It normally hurts an officer so badly that he or she cannot stay with the agency anymore.
Recognizing it as a problem is a good start, and fixing it is, of course, an ideal. But specifically, how do you make that happen? Do you have an example of another police force that has done this?
You know, I really don't. I wish I could say so. But I think there is a way that you could begin to break this. The mayor and all of the chief administrators have to stand up and say, we will protect you. And they need to go down and handpick a select group of officers who they know the field respects and have them come front and say, you know what, it's time for us to stop this code of silence. It's time for us to speak up and root these people who tarnish our star out of the agency.
I'm wondering, in this year where there has been unprecedented scrutiny of the nation's police forces, as well as officers being charged, as someone who has audited police departments, you've literally written the book on internal affairs, do you think that this might be, for at least a place like Chicago and maybe other places, really be the time when some change will happen?
I do. I think that this is a historic moment. One of the major revelations that came out of this is that nationally, we really have no idea how many people are killed by the police, either in use of force or in custody deaths. That's what's astounded law enforcement even. I mean, that in itself is ridiculous. The other concern, and I think we're seeing this nationwide, for years, we've hidden behind the confidentiality of internal affairs. That's coming to an end. I mean, we see in California legislation saying you can no longer have secret grand juries look at police-involved shootings. So transparency is becoming more and more common. And I think those two issues right there are going to drag law enforcement kicking and screaming into an era where the police truly are the community and the community are the police.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Renee, my pleasure.
Lou Reeder was with the LAPD for 20 years and has spent many more years as a police consultant and trainer.
Let's listen next to a presidential candidate seeking special status in the new year. Marco Rubio hopes to make himself the top choice of so-called establishment Republicans, those who hope to overcome the likes of Donald Trump. Rubio is challenging his fellow Floridian Jeb Bush for that establishment role. NPR's Sarah McCammon spent yesterday with Rubio in Iowa.
In the small town of Newton, Marco Rubio was joined by his family and a colleague from Congress. Trey Gowdy is best known for his role as chairman of the House Benghazi Committee. He set the tone for the event, defending Rubio's record on immigration. Gowdy said he's 100% confident Rubio understands the link between that issue and national security.
You do not have a right to immigrate from another country to the United States. And sovereign countries have the right to determine who gets to come and how long you get to stay. And if you don't stay, we have the right, just like the uncle at Christmas time, we have the right to say, look, it's time to go.
Several Iowans who came to see Rubio said the endorsement from the South Carolina congressman doesn't have much bearing on their feelings. But it comes at a good time for Rubio, whose record on immigration is an area of vulnerability. The Florida senator has been attacked by rivals like Ted Cruz for his role in an attempt to pass an immigration plan that included a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. In Newton, Rubio said he's concerned about the threat of terrorists infiltrating the U.S. through the immigration system.
The issue has changed, and so too must our approach. There was a time not long ago when people didn't lock their doors. Do any of you remember that, when people didn't used to lock their doors? They lock their doors now. Why? Because the world has changed.
In a year when voters are flocking to candidates like Cruz and Donald Trump, Rubio is telling Iowa voters he also cares about immigration and border security. He's calling for 20,000 new border agents and stepped up enforcement at airports and seaports. Rubio's parents emigrated from Cuba, so he's making the case that he's in a unique position to talk about the issue. That's what he told a modest crowd in the central Iowa town of Boone.
I am the son of immigrants, and as the son of immigrants, I know that enforcing our immigration laws is not anti-immigrant. It is what sovereign countries do.
Rubio is also aiming some of his rhetoric at evangelical voters, a key bloc among Iowa Republicans. In a single line that served as a multi-pronged attack on President Obama, he touched on a top priority for religious conservatives.
And our president, instead of fighting for more funding for our troops, keeps fighting for more funding for his pet program, like Planned Parenthood.
For Steve Lawler, a farmer from nearby Ogden, Rubio is hitting all the right notes. Lawler says he's still considering other Republican candidates, but he likes Rubio's take on national security and the federal budget, and he thinks Rubio could win the general election.
I see him as a very civil conservative, and I think he probably espouses some of the same views that Cruz and Trump do, but I think he does a better job at delivering the message and makes it more understandable to a wide range of voters on both sides of the aisle.
With just over a month before the Iowa caucuses, Rubio needs to first deliver an effective message to the Republican base. Sarah McCammon, NPR News, Des Moines.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:41, and coming up next, we'll have headlines for you from NPR and WPR, and then in 10 minutes on Marketplace Morning Report, how bad behavior at workplaces can be like an addiction. That plus all the morning's business news in 10 minutes here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Updating software can be a pain, but if you don't do it,
we lost all contact with the ground, and we lost insight into all of the systems of our ship.
I'm Adrienne Hill, the multi-billion dollar software business from phones to spaceships. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Tune into Marketplace tonight at 6:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Security concerns in Belgium are prompting officials to cancel the traditional New Year's Eve fireworks in Brussels. Terry Schultz says this follows a series of arrests authorities are linking to a New Year's terrorist plot.
The two suspects arrested earlier this week have now been formally charged with threatening and planning terrorist attacks. One will also face charges of recruiting others to participate in the New Year's Eve plot. Seven more raids were carried out this morning throughout Brussels, resulting in six arrests and the seizure of computer equipment, cell phones, and items used to simulate military-style warfare.
Earlier today, a Belgian national was arrested and charged with terror-related offenses connected to last month's deadly attacks in Paris, claimed by ISIS. They left 130 people dead. Nearly 6,000 police officers will be on the streets of New York City tonight for New Year's Eve in Times Square. Officials estimate 1 million people will be there for the festivities. Republican presidential candidate Jeb Bush says his campaign is adding more staffers and shifting its TV ad purchases ahead of Iowa and New Hampshire.
You know, the good news is expectations are low for me, and I'm definitely going to beat those. I feel really good about New Hampshire.
That's Bush speaking to NPR. He says he's in the race to stay regardless of how he does in the early GOP primaries. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. Almost 217,000 Wisconsin residents have signed up for new health insurance under the Affordable Care Act or had their current plans renewed. They're among 8.5 million people who have arranged their coverage in 38 states that use the federal government's purchasing exchanges. The figures include sign-ups and renewals between November 1st, when open enrollment began, and last weekend. Officials have projected that almost 10 million Americans will have some type of Obamacare coverage by the end of next year. Enrollments continue until January 15th for insurance that begins in February, and people have until January 31st to sign up for health plans that kick in March. Some relatives of Milwaukee's murder victims are praying for a safer new year. City leaders joined families and friends of this year's 145 homicide victims at a church service last night on the city's north side. Candles were lit as each victim's name was read. Almost 60 more people were killed in Milwaukee this year than last. The 2015 homicide toll is at its highest since 1991, when Milwaukee had 165 killings. There will be isolated flurries this morning in Wisconsin, and highs will be in the upper teens in the northwest to the mid-20s in the east. And tonight, a chance of light snow in the northwest with isolated flurries in the far north. This is WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship. More information is available at skoll.org. From the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities through grant-making and social investing. More at kresge.org. And from the estate of Miles Gatterman, whose bequest is a tribute to NPR's ongoing dedication to music and the arts.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Those looking for a story about how Ms. or Mr. Smith goes to Washington and fixes everything, well, they'll be disappointed in this one. Democrat Ann Ravel has led the Federal Election Commission for the past year. That's the agency that enforces campaign finance laws. And as she steps aside as chair, Ravel spoke to NPR's Peter Overby about leading what she calls a broken agency.
Unlike Mr. Smith in the movie, Ann Ravel didn't come to Washington as a neophyte. A Californian, she's been a government lawyer for years. In 2013, the California Campaign Finance Agency cracked down on some prominent nonprofit groups. She was head of the agency.
We're here to announce today that a record fine for a campaign violation in the state of California of $1 million has been levied against a dark money network of political nonprofits.
2 weeks after that, Ravel arrived at the FEC.
I actually realized after about a week or two that what was being done was essentially nothing.
The commission has three Republicans and three Democrats. Party line votes are routine. In an interview on the day of her final meeting as chair, Ravel said she began at the FEC looking for ways the two sides could work together.
But obviously I was naive.
In 2014, Ravel tried crossing the partisan divide. She voted with the Republicans to dismiss 20 enforcement cases. Also, to finally set rules supporting the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision.
One, I thought that it was the right thing to do.
And second, she wanted to change the atmosphere.
To create some goodwill in the hopes that there would be some willingness to work with me on issues that I care about, such as disclosure.
Even Citizens United praises disclosure. That's the case that unleashed corporate and union money in elections. But the FEC's Republicans say Congress makes the law. Here's Republican Commissioner Matthew Peterson at this month's meeting. He's the incoming chairman.
I don't view my role as a commissioner to feel like I step into the void when Congress doesn't act.
Meanwhile, Ravel held a day-long hearing for the public, something unheard of at the agency. On a small listening tour, in op-eds and speeches, she said political money affects Americans' daily lives more than you'd think, and the agency is broken. Back at the FEC, they couldn't even agree on bagels or donuts for an office celebration. So dealing with a four-year backlog of enforcement cases? Fat chance. Democrats want to use existing laws. Republicans want to wait for new challenges to the laws to be settled. At the September meeting, Republican Caroline Hunter said Democrats used to stall cases, too.
The difference is we have legitimate reasons why we're waiting on a couple of matters. And I just explained them to you. And so please don't sit there and just forget history and just, you know, go on and on about how it's just the Republicans' fault when it's not.
Peterson, the incoming chair, said in an interview that the commission was set up not to be efficient, but to keep Americans safe.
Safe from partisan enforcement of the law and safe from an overly aggressive interpretation enforcement that could infringe upon First Amendment protected activities.
Ravel talks about a session she had last summer with House and Senate interns. At the end,
a number of these kids raised their hands and said, I don't vote. Why bother? I mean, if those kids aren't engaged in these issues, I want to continue to try to do something to change that.
Revel's term at the FEC runs for one more year. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
And this is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock on this final day of 2015. Thanks for joining us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And stay with us for classical music. That starts at 9. And today, we'll have some music for New Year's Eve. Be sure to join us tomorrow morning at 10 for the annual New Year's Day concert by Vienna Philharmonic, featuring plenty of favorite waltzes, polkas, and more. Stay with us. The Marketplace Morning Report is coming up next.
Support for WGTD comes from Carthage College, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad.
Radical robots and gadgets galore. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support science exploration and education. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
There will be isolated flurries this morning in Wisconsin, with highs in the upper teens in the northwest to the mid-20s in the east. And tonight, there's a chance of light snow in the northwest with isolated flurries in the far north. It's going to be cold. Lows will be about 10 degrees in the southwest to 15 degrees in the far north and near Lake Michigan.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Security Health Plan, offering a variety of Medicare coverage options, including a Medicare supplement plan available statewide. Information is available at securityhealth.org.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market. The market opens Saturdays during the cold weather season, and the atrium of the Rohde Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha is currently on break. It'll reopen Saturday, January 9th. For more, visit KenoshaHarborMarket.com.
Ooh, it's close. Will the S&P 500 stock index close up or down for the year?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. Right now, the S&P 500 is down 0.3% since the beginning of January, meaning, depending on how things go on this last trading session of the year, that key stock index could be positive or negative for 2016. Let's say Happy New Year to Diane Swong, Chief Economist at Mesirow Financial in Chicago.
Happy New Year.
I'm not quite saying the same Happy New Year about share prices, at least if you look at the index, the S&P 500. You know, treaded water here for the year.
Not sure it exactly treaded water. I think some of it was like a monsoon. This was a real choppy ride. We were up well over 18,000, nipping close to 19,000 on the S&P and or on the Dow. And now, you know, we're back down to sort of where we started the year. So it seems treading water, but I think there was a lot more work in it for anyone who was an investor out on Wall Street or those traders who are making bets. I know traders make bets a lot.
Do you see a number like this connected to the real economy where you and I live and breathe? Or does the stock market have sort of a different logic here as we're getting into 2016?
Well, actually, I see what's going on as somewhat positive. I think we're finally handing off the baton from Wall Street to Main Street. And what we're going to be looking at this year is if we finally don't tread water for wages. What we want to see is wages rise, consumers pick up. They have been carrying the economy for a little over a year now, and they're doing better. We enter the year with a little more optimism. We need some more wages out there to regain some ground lost, and I think that's going to be the theme of this year. Do we really get there? We won't get all the way to where we need to be, but I think we're going to feel a lot better on Main Street, perhaps than Wall Street, as it has a turbulent ride still ahead of it.
Well, it's actually a good note. Maybe we should report hour to hour average hourly earnings instead of these crazy stock market indicators.
I think that would be something welcome news. And average hourly earnings going up instead of staying flat, that would be something we'd all welcome. And so would Wall Street, because it would mean finally this economy is getting a little bit of a temperature to it instead of being tepid.
Diane Swong, Chief Economist at Mesirow Financial. Talk to you in about a week.
Happy New Year.
Now let's do the numbers at the moment. Well, the Dow's down 109 points, 0.6%. So is the NASDAQ Composite Index in percentage terms. The S&P 500 down 0.5%. The 10-year Treasury yield is down at 2.27%, with the bond market closing early for New Year's Eve. The stock market stays open to the bittersweet end. In the United Kingdom, parliamentary lawyers have been hard at work drafting a bill which could best be described as legislative house cleaning or even legal refuse collection. The bill is designed to clean up the statute book there, to repeal some of the quaint, outdated, and sometimes offensive laws that remain in force. For example, under one ancient English statute, it is illegal to beat a wife after 9 o'clock at night out of noise considerations. From the House of Commons in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports on the cleaning up of vestigial laws.
The Queen commands this honorable house.
After 900 years of lawmaking, this parliament has amassed many curious relics. These leather-bound statute books, some dating back to the Middle Ages, contain provisions never formally repealed. Nigel Cawthorne, author of The Strange Laws of Old England.
Often when they are introducing new laws, they simply amend old laws and odd clauses get stuck by the wayside.
And are still technically in force today.
It is illegal to fire a cannon within 300 yards of a dwelling house. It's illegal to eat a mute swan, unless you're the Queen, of course. And it's illegal to beat a carpet in the street, although you can shake a mat before 8 o'clock in the morning.
It's also illegal to enter Parliament wearing a suit of armour, but the lawmakers are determined to drag the British statute book into the 21st century. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Epson, innovating receipt printers. Epson checkout printers are used in grocery stores, department stores, and restaurants throughout the world. Where there's business, there's Epson. Learn more at epson.com/forbusiness.
It's the time of year when we take stock of ourselves and how we can improve. We can exercise more. We can eat less salt, less meat, less kombucha. It may also be a time to work on how we behave at work. Keith Ferrazzi is the CEO of Ferrazzi Greenlight, a research-based consulting and training company. Good morning to you, Keith.
Good morning, David.
So you hang out with fancy executives and sometimes they have weird habits.
Not just weird habits, but in many regards, debilitative habits. I am absolutely shocked within the hallowed halls of large corporations how many times you bump up against very successful executives who are holding themselves back. I've come to call these behaviors addictions. We all have small addictions. It may not be smoking, but we have procrastination, we have temper, we have conflict avoidance, we have bragging, we have shaming people in our feedback. They hold us back and we do them anyway. That's an addiction.
So if one has a drinking problem, there are some time-tested methods that have helped many people. You would like to borrow from that construct.
Well, we all know what the first step is, isn't it? We've got to admit that we have a problem. So the most important thing for us is to stop being ashamed of our ridiculous behaviors and just recognize it's the stupid stuff that makes us human. Yes, I have a temper. Yes, I brag. So admit your problem. Pick one.
So the first step is the famous step. Give me a couple more steps. Not all 12, but give me a couple of them, Keith.
The other thing is to live your life in daily consultation. This is a real tenet of the 12-step program where you have a sponsor or a buddy. So what I advise executives to do is to find an individual that you're really going to trust and feel safe with and let that individual know that this is a behavior you're working on. And let that individual know that when you feel that behavior coming on, or right after you've done it, it's okay. You call a friend and say, hey, I'm just bookending this. Right before I go into this meeting, I'd like to let you know I'm paying attention to this.
But the key is to find the right person.
Exactly. Find somebody that feels safe and that you trust. You've got to make sure that you enlist the people around you, if you feel comfortable enough, in just asking other people for help in advance.
Keith Ferrazzi, CEO of Ferrazzi Greenlight. Among his books, Who's Got Your Back? Keith, thank you.
My pleasure, David.
And the flagship Toys R Us store in New York's Times Square has just closed for good. The fancy one with the Ferris wheel inside, a tourist destination for many with kids in tow. Times Square real estate just got too expensive, and now Toys R Us is looking for new space somewhere in Manhattan. For now, you'll just have to plan a trip to the one in the local mall, where it should be almost as fun, right? In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
And you can hear the Morning Report every hour during Morning Edition here on WPR. Join us, too, for the evening edition of Marketplace the day's business news for you starting at 6:30 each weeknight, and that's right after All Things Considered. Check out our program schedule at WPR.org.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio is provided by the John W. and Lenore L. Landry Endowment Fund, supporting educational and informational programming like The Larry Mueller Show, in the spirit of the outreach mission of the University of Wisconsin.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, applications are now being accepted from Kenosha County High School seniors for Gunlock Scholarships. The deadline is February 29th. Seven $3,000 scholarships were awarded last year. For more, contact the Kenosha Community Foundation.
You're listening to WGTD.